Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Underwear, armpit hair, many imitators, but no one compares.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four!
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast. Three women, one podcast, and a whole load of badass with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and Emma Sexton. This week, we meet the extraordinary Alexandra Adams. She's the UK's first nearly a doctor who's both deaf and blind. She tells us how she came into medicine, why she's had such a crazy life and what it's taught her, and really what facing life and death on a regular basis teaches you about our own mortality. Plus, we speak to a new campaign trying to make sure that those mental health illnesses that we don't talk about as much get the same kind of coverage and understanding. Our first guest today is Alexandra Adams. Alexandra made the news recently when she realised she was probably the first ever medical student, nearly doctor, to be both deaf and blind. She's been progressing through medical school for the last 4 years and trying to make it in the real world of medicine, but it hasn't always been easy. Alexandra, when you turned up to medical school, you were probably the first deaf and blind student that they had experienced. What was the response like to that?
It's been really mixed. So I'm in my fourth year of medical school. I've got one more year left. From patients, the response has been amazing. They're really sort of, you know, open to allowing me to examine them, take histories, etc. And actually, they're more interested in finding out my story because they can relate to me as a person at a human level. But throughout medical school, actually, the problems I've had is with colleagues. So I can remember on my first day of placement, a senior doctor came up to me and said, imagine you're a patient. Would you want a disabled doctor treating you? Absolutely not. And then I was sent home. And I have another doctor come up to me and say, what are you doing with the patient's cane? I said, well, I'm really sorry, but the cane's my cane. I'm registered blind. I'm a medical student. And this doctor just looked at me in disgust and said, I don't want you touching any of the patients. So it's been a really mixed bag. And in a way, I kind of almost expected there to be some kind of, you know, raised eyebrows and stuff, because it is. It's different. It's not the norm to have someone who is deafblind on the wards. But I didn't realise that the discrimination was going to be so bad.
Why do you think that discrimination has happened? Is it... So tell us, we're saying deafblind for people who can't see you right now. Tell us where you are on that scale and what it means for you
so
in your daily life.
There is a spectrum with any disability, I guess, but with my visual and hearing impairment, the best way to describe it is that I was born with both of them, and my visual impairment is that I've got just under 5% vision in my left, none in my right, and in my left eye, I can only see centrally, so I don't see on the side. And with my hearing, I have severe to profound hearing loss, which surprises a lot of people, actually, because I don't sound like a stereotypically deaf person. But when I take my hearing aids out, I am completely, utterly deaf, which is a great thing because I can ignore people when I want to. So that is my spectrum of my disability. And, yeah, it's really difficult because I think for people that don't understand the disability because they don't have it themselves, I can understand it. It's impossible to imagine having a doctor that can turn up, take blood from your veins, or, you know, listen to your heart. But actually, there are so many ways. And it's not, I mean, even, well, amongst most of my colleagues, it's not a malicious thing. It is purely because they just don't understand it. It's like this oblivious ignorance as to what needs to be done and how things need to be approached. In a way, because it's not a normal topic of conversation, I think people are just scared. Scared to sort of face it and say, oh, you know, what do we do with this disabled person?
And you know, do you have to have any different ways of adapting medical tests or the way that you examine patients?
So, yeah, I mean, there's lots of equipment that I've discovered along the way throughout medical school that can help me. So, for instance, with a stethoscope, because I can't take my hearing aids out because I'll be completely deaf, I cannot hear through a normal stethoscope. But I have this amazing piece of kit from America, and it's a Bluetooth stethoscope. So it's literally just, for those at home that can imagine a normal stethoscope, it's literally just the end. And I flick a switch on my hearing aid, it goes to sort of the Bluetooth section, and then I can listen to people's hearts and lungs without even putting anything in my ears. Actually, people, well, particularly the children, think that I've got super hearing, which is always good. I just need my X-ray specs now. but no, there are plenty of gadgets out there. But actually, a lot of the time, the basic stuff, like taking blood or inserting cannulas, it's about knowing what to do, for starters. And a lot of it is about feeling, it's about touch and knowing your anatomy. And actually, because I'm visually impaired, I need to know it better than most people. I could, in theory, take blood with my eyes closed, and it's because my sense of touch is far better than other people, because that's what I've had to rely on as a visually impaired person.
And so that's what I was going to ask. Have none of the doctors pointed out the benefits? So I immediately thought, okay, there's an empathy that you will have with patients, for a start, that other doctors may or may not have. Your heightened sense of touch will be different. And just what you said around Bluetooth, I bet that's a much better listening experience than doing it through a stethoscope, to be honest.
Yeah. So it actually picks up, when we made a stethoscope, it picks up more sound than normal stethoscopes. It's really, really high tech. So actually, I hear far more than I need to at the level that I am as a fourth year medical student. But I don't know. It's just, I mean, I've had some amazing colleagues who have been really, really good, you know, on the wards. But some of them are really like, I think they don't want to accept that there's other ways, because they're maybe used to the traditional way of doing medicine, being a doctor. You know, I went to the USA in 2017 in search of blind and deaf doctors, because I you know, I've got to be realistic. I'm a very optimistic person, but I had to make sure that what I was doing was really possible, really doable. And I met 5 completely blind doctors, more blind than me, and completely deaf doctor as well. And it was interesting, because the biggest difference out there wasn't the technology or the use of gadgets. It wasn't necessarily the financial situation that they were in or the healthcare system. The biggest difference was actually that their colleagues were more willing to sit down and say, do you know what, okay, you've got a disability, but how can we accommodate for you in the best way possible so that you can fulfil in your career? It's all about communication and teamwork.
And do you think also today, because we have so much technology now that is in the processes and in the way that we diagnose, actually is probably a better time for somebody like yourself to be able to go into the medical profession?
Absolutely. You know, like you said, I mean, I think I'm in Wales at the moment, and I think to some extent the Welsh NHS are a little behind. So we are very much still on pen and paper on the ward round, whereas down here, I've been a patient in a London hospital, and they go around with a computer on wheels. And it is, it's literally just the kind of the basics of upcoming technology that can really benefit not just people like me, but everyone. So as soon as we start using these gadgets universally, then medicine as a career will become more accessible to everyone, including people like myself with sensory impairments.
What made you want to become a doctor?
Very good question. So this is classic medical school interview question. So I didn't always want to be a doctor. And I think it was because when I was younger, well, when you're a kid, you always look up to other people and you naturally take on the advice. So if someone says, oh, you can't be a doctor because you're visually and hearing impaired, then you kind of take that. But I always knew that I wanted to go into a field that involved caring for people. Mm-hmm. But then I ended up in hospital for a year and a half. So I had stomach surgery. It was an elective surgery to essentially get me back swimming, because I was on the GB swimming team and I was having some really bad problems with my stomach and respiratory problems as well. And this surgery was supposed to, you know, cure everything and get me back into the water. Unfortunately, it went terribly wrong and they ended up having 20 stomach surgeries in that year.
Wow.
And I was bedbound for the entire time, on epidurals, morphine, everything. And it was interesting because it was when I was in the patient in the bed,
yeah,
that I really, I had a lot of time to waste, didn't I? I had a lot of time to observe and see what made the good doctors and what made the bad doctors. And I can remember clearly every single day, the morning ward round, a huge bunch of doctors would come round and they would stand at the invisible line that separated the end of the bed, you know, between them and me. Yeah. And not once did they look at me, you know, and just say, this is what's going on, Alexandra. This is yeah, what's going to happen next. And then they moved on to the next patient. And I was, what, 16, 17? And the hospital I was in, I was deemed as being an adult. So I wasn't on a paediatric ward. I was on a general surgical ward. And the majority of patients had dementia. So you can imagine I was a teenager. I was really, really isolated. But there was this one doctor that came back and she asked me probably the three most important words that any patient wants to hear. And they were, are you okay? Well, obviously, that was the first time anyone had asked me that question in a very long time. And I burst into tears and I said, no. And I told her how frightened I was. And she just smiled. She got up and she closed the curtains around the bed. She said, I know how you feel. And all of a sudden, she just lifted up her blouse, which is not something the doctor does every day. But she showed me a huge scar along her ribs. And so she'd been in hospital at a similar period to me, a similar age. And not only has she taught me that she was giving me empathy, but she also taught me that I would have a ton of this empathy to give if I chose to be a doctor in the future and give back to my patients. So I think really it was kind of, that was the turning point. It was, do you know what? I'm having this terrible life experience right now, but I can turn it round and make good use of it to help others.
Alexandra, you're incredible. We're going to keep talking to you here on Badass Women's Hour.
Badass Women's Hour is Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton. Three women, one podcast and a whole load of badass. As long as Mercury isn't in retrograde.
Alexandra, before the break, we were talking about your experience of the healthcare system and being in hospital, going through 20-odd stomach operations. And that happened because you were a GB swimmer.
Mm-hmm.
So you clearly have a level of grit and resilience. Tell us about life when you were young. So you were born, as you said, with hearing and eyesight impairment, and yet you still made it onto the GB team for swimming and skiing.
So I mean, as a kid, I mean, lots of people ask me this question. I think as I was growing up, life was fairly normal. I think my parents tried to make sure that I had as normal a childhood as possible and that I did everything that any other child at that age would do. So they got me involved in sport, music, brownies, you know, everything. So for me, I didn't really see myself as being any different. I didn't see my disability as being any different. But I come from a family of swimmers, apart from my mum, who kind of just drove us back and forth to the side. But no, my dad and my sister were really sort of involved swimmers, and the house permanently smelled of chlorine, you know. And I don't really know how it all happened, but I just naturally found myself in a position where I was competing. And then when I was 11, I think actually I was still in primary school and I went to my first national championships and I came away with 5 gold and 1 silver and broke a few records. And I think from there, someone from the swimming team said, oh, you know, would you be interested in taking this further? Which is kind of what I did. And naturally, it just kind of went in that direction. So I spent most of my teenage years before ending up in a hospital as an athlete. So I would get up at 4:30 in the morning, go training, swimming training, come back, dry my hair, go to school, come back, do my homework. And if I didn't do my homework, I wouldn't go swimming training in the evening.
Wow.
And that was my life, day in, day out. And, you know, I mean,
did you enjoy that?
I think, oh, it's such a chore. But, you know, I loved it. And I got to I got to travel everywhere for competitions. And it was my life. So as you can probably imagine, when I ended up in hospital and afterwards, when I came out, I suddenly realised that actually that was my sporting career well and truly over. So I had to adapt considerably. And then with the skiing, I mean, that's another long story in itself, but I came out of hospital when I was nearly 18, and I wasn't accepted back into a school because that is school leaving age. So my only option was to go to a residential school for blind students. And I'd gone from being completely dependent, bedbound for that year and a half, to moving away entirely from home, 4 hours away, and not only, you know, having to sort of teach myself my A-level subjects, because unfortunately they didn't really sort of push students into university at the school. I had to do my own shopping, washing, cleaning, cooking. So I literally went, you know, from being completely dependent to really independent. And it was when I was at that school that said, oh, hey, there's an opportunity to go on a ski trip. And my family have never been to the mountains, let alone skiing. And I thought, oh, this sounds like a challenge. You know, I like a little bit of an extreme sport. Let's give it a go. And within a week, I learned how to ski. I had someone who, well, taught me to put my feet on skis, but also guided me, because when I ski, I don't see anything. I just see white. I don't see the depth, or I don't see when we're about to fall off the side of the mountain, you know, which is a good thing, actually, I think. And it's great. And we communicated via Bluetooth headsets in the helmets. And I came away from that trip and thought, whoa, you know, I really enjoyed that. And then 2 months later, I found out that the gentleman who had taught me how to ski and who had guided me, he died. He died in an avalanche. And you would think that actually that would really scare me. I mean, I was really sad, but actually it made me more determined to carry on the sport that he had introduced me to loving. And so I decided just for the fun of it, really, to go to an indoor ski centre. And I hadn't realised that throughout the whole time when I was just having fun, just going up and down, you know, that there was someone in the corner watching me and said, oh, you know, you're visually impaired. How long have you been skiing for? And I said, well, actually, this is my second time on skis. And he goes, oh, would you be interested in taking it further? Like, I've got contacts and, you know, we can get you on the team and you can compete. And I was like, OK, go on then. You know, let's give it a go. So yeah, that's kind of how it all went.
Just like that.
And it's funny you bring that up. Actually, because I can talk about this in more detail in a bit, but I've recently been diagnosed with another condition which has landed me in intensive care 17 times to date. And consequently, I did end up having to stop skiing competitively. But at the beginning of 2020, I thought, you know what, I want to set myself another challenge. I want to, you know, restart the things that I enjoy doing, the things that I love. And I thought, well, as soon as I get a weekend free, I'm going to go skiing. You know, I'm just going to do it. And I came back this Monday from Austria. I went skiing. It was great. I only skied for 2 days, but it was so nice because I love that idea of freedom and speed. You know, I can't see what's coming before me. I literally have no clue. Wow. But actually, I think that's better.
I think that's the best way, actually. Yeah. As somebody who can see, I said it's very scary. You've now been diagnosed with something else. Tell us about that.
So I started getting some really bad respiratory problems. So I would sort of just go into respiratory arrest at the spur of the moment. So no warning whatsoever. And so I've ended up in intensive care quite a few times. And they've done a few tests. And I mean, it's not been a straightforward thing. And it's taken a long time. But they're thinking there's something going on at a cellular level. So a mitochondria, which is kind of the battery to your cells. So essentially, I'm told that if I overexert, then my body just decides to shut down completely. But the thing is, I have no idea what they mean by overexert. Do they mean don't run a marathon?
Yeah.
Or do they mean don't walk down the street? And I really do not know. So, again, that's just been another sort of dramatic lifestyle change I've had to adapt to. And actually, it, you know, very high chances that it could happen again, and I just have to almost be prepared, but at the same time not let it affect my life from every day. You know, I can still go out and enjoy stuff. I just need to accept that this is what could happen, and you've just got to deal with it in the moment. And it's been really difficult at times, because obviously I'm at medical school and I'm doing all this other stuff. And, you know, when I do have a, and I call it a blip, I mean, they're quite big blips. Yeah. But it's just having to, like, rebuild yourself each time. I mean, I had a particularly bad admission last summer. So I was in Italy on my first girls' holiday. And I, long story short, I got sepsis and respiratory failure and pneumonia. And I was on life support for 3 weeks. And my parents were told that I would return to the UK in a box. And they had to fly out to come and see me. And they flew into Genoa. And they drove down in a hire car to the first hospital I was in before I was transferred to a hospital in Milan. Mm. And I don't know if you heard about it in the news, but they went over a bridge in Genoa, which collapsed and killed 43 people just 3 hours before it went. And so obviously that happened. That was traumatic for my parents, let alone, you know, being told that their daughter was, you know, pretty much on the brink. But I had hideous delirium, and to this day I still can't describe how real delirium is. It's like a nightmare, but so much more. It's like a nightmare in 4D. So you feel it, you smell it, you hear it, you taste it. And I can remember vividly, even now when I'm describing it to you, I genuinely thought I was in a plane crash and I had been spewed out onto the airport runway, and I can feel the heat of the concrete, but I can't move. I then thought I was hanging off the edge of the building for weeks. I was constantly asking the hospital staff, please pull me back up off the side. And then I was in my own coffin, and I was genuinely convinced that I was at my own funeral, and everything was getting colder and whiter. And I can just remember hearing crying in the background. But do you know what? I was so weak and so exhausted. I'd almost got to that point where I'd accepted that I was leaving the world. I was going. And it was so, so real. And that was probably my worst. I mean, I've had quite a few intensive care admissions since then. I had two before Christmas, actually. But that was probably my worst by far.
All of this stuff happening, what understanding does it give you about life? Because I feel like, as a doctor anyway, I feel like doctors have a different understanding really of life and death, because they are confronting it every single day. And then you looking at your life, which has been a series of, you shouldn't be able to do this, this shouldn't be possible, this can't be happening, it's not going to look like this, it's not going to work in this way, and you're just being like, and knocking that one, and knocking that one, and knocking that one. What has it given you as a kind of, I guess, a life philosophy?
That is a very deep question, and I love these kind of questions, because I could literally talk for England and Wales about this, and it is really interesting. I mean, it's definitely taught me a lot about other people and patients, particularly from the perspective of a medical student and future doctor. You know, it really has helped me think, you know, when I go and see this patient in hospital, not just, oh, what's their blood test result or what's their CT scan showing, it's how are they feeling psychosocially, how are they, how are they emotionally? Because we will never know, you know, as experienced as we become, you know, in the job, we will never, you know, 100% personally know what that person's going through. And you just have to be able to sit down and say, I sympathise. But actually, in my, you know, perspective, I am able to empathise at some points. But for me, I mean, lots of people ask me this, you know, if you could change everything, if you could stop all these really bad things happening, would you go back and change them? And I've always said no, because actually, as traumatic as some of them have been, they have given me this really valuable life experience, which I see as a gift. And actually, it's given me more strength and sort of, well, experience as a person, which I really cherish. And actually, you know what, it teaches you the fact that, you know, life goes on, you know, and there are some things in life you cannot control, and you just have to be able to accept it and say, okay, so this has happened, I'm going to move on, I'm going to make the most of it. And I think once you're able to have that acceptance, it makes you a lot more sort of a powerful sort of in what you do, in the decisions you make. And I have got myself into so many palavers. I mean, I've travelled the world solo, and the number of times I have got lost. I mean, I got lost in a forest. I got lost in a desert. I found myself on the hard shoulder of a motorway in Hong Kong. Don't even ask me how I managed to do it. But I thought, do you know what? I can't sit on the floor and cry, because that is really not going to change anything. It's not going to help. I need to get up. I need to carry on walking forward, because eventually you're going to end up somewhere. And hopefully that destination's a little bit better than where you've left from. So that's kind of what it's taught me to do. I just sort of carry on through life and just embrace whatever comes your way.
Great philosophy.
Yeah.
Thank you for so much for coming in and talking to us. Alexandra, you've just been an absolute phenomenon. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us tonight, but also for actually turning up and saying, do you know what? I think I might be able to make a difference in some people's lives, and I'm going to do it. And I think anyone who's in your care is incredibly lucky.
Yes.
So thank you for having me. Amazing. Alexandra Adams, just blowing all our minds there.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Thank you for listening to Badass Women's Hour. You can hear us every Saturday on Talk Radio from 7 p.m. for a full 3 hours, yes, 3 hours, of opinion, debate and general setting the world to rights. Now, let's get back to our guest. We are talking about mental health. Now, we talk about mental health a lot on this show, but in particular, we talk about kind of the simple ways to get around it. So we talk about mindfulness. We talk about making sure that you're talking to someone and being there for people who are going through it. And yet, despite our growing awareness as a society around mental health, 27% of people with a less common mental health problem, such as schizophrenia, BPD and psychosis, feel discrimination against them has increased in the last 10 years. Mm. Here to talk about it with us is Jo Loughran, Director of Time to Change. Hi, Jo.
Good evening. Nice to be here.
Why do we think that people facing, well, for a start, BPD, I wanted to say bipolar disorder, is that correct?
Borderline personality disorder,
thank you. Why do people feel that discrimination has increased? Because surely if we've been talking about it more, we should be more open.
We should. So basically, Time to Change have been working for the last 12 years, really, to get us talking more about mental health problems. So we definitely know that we're talking about depression and we're talking about OCD. But what we think is happening is that, and the research is telling us, is that people are experiencing more less common conditions like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or psychosis are not necessarily benefiting from the improvement in attitudes that we've seen over the last 12 years since we've been working at Time to Change. So a good example of that is when we ask people about depression, for example, they could tell us what depression was. They could maybe talk about some of the symptoms that were involved in that. But when we ask them about schizophrenia or bipolar, only 50% of people had either ever heard of that or knew and were able to tell us a little bit about maybe what one of those symptoms might be. So you can see there's a disparity there. So what we're trying to do now is we're really trying to showcase those conditions. So we've got some fantastic stuff on the Time to Change website. We've got three wonderful films, Billy, Jason and Antonio, who are really talking about what it's like to live with those conditions.
And can you give us a little bit of what it is we mean when we talk about things like schizophrenia or borderline personality disorder or psychosis? Because they seem like very big words, I guess. I think when we think of schizophrenia, probably for most of us, our experience of that is what we see on TV or on film, which is very much sensationalised.
And there's the key. So that's the issue that we have is that if we don't know anything, then that stigma is really fed by a lack of knowledge and a lack of understanding. So what we want to really do is we want to be able to humanise the experiences so that we can see that these are people who are experiencing conditions, and that's part of who they are. It doesn't define who they are. So yes, you're right. Lots of stuff that we have. We take facts and figures from maybe sensationalist headlines or from films. So the best place to get more information is to go onto the website. So it's time-2change.org.uk. And from there, you can then also get some information on Rethink Mental Illness website and also the Mind website, which tells you a little bit more about the facts of what all of those conditions are.
Yeah.
So we have actually spoken about this on the show before. We were talking about mental health and the fact that actually there are lots of mental health conditions that aren't, see, I'm going to say, quote, palatable. And I think it's partly because we've got to a place where you've got your Love Islanders and lots of glossy folks saying, I suffer from anxiety, and almost making it more palatable. What we don't have is people actually talking about forms of mental health conditions that in the public minds might be seen as more dangerous. And again, I'm quoting more dangerous. And that for me is possibly where the conversation around mental health hasn't gone so far. And from my own experience and from family experience, there's a large number of black men that have been sectioned and in hospitals with schizophrenia or personality disorder, and they are totally forgotten and left behind. And they're not given the same loving embrace or column inches that, say, a young, gorgeous, pretty woman who's suffered from anxiety for X number of years has. And they probably won't ever be given those column inches or listened to in the same way either. And so how do we really get people that are standing on those platforms talking about their mental health, I'm quoting their mental health, talking about mental health for everyone?
Yeah, because the only person, celebrity, that I can think of that had, one of these more extreme disorders is Kerry Katona, who's bipolar.
Frank Bruno.
Oh,
as well.
Frank Bruno.
But
okay.
I remember when Frank Bruno came out in the press maybe 5-6 years ago, maybe longer.
I remember depression for him. What was he? Did he have something? Was he schizophrenic as well?
So going into it, there were it was broader than just depression.
Yeah. But I even remember Kerry Katona because she did that famous interview on This Morning where she'd taken her drugs for her mental illness, and she got so much stick for that. I don't remember seeing any empathy or understanding for her bipolar condition, and just a lot of misunderstanding, judging her, assuming that she was drunk when she did that interview and not believing it was the drug. So there aren't those role models. You're right, we're not seeing those stories at all.
And I think really what we've got to do is we've got to be able to change that kind of societal norm. So we've seen that with depression, and we've seen that with anxiety and with those sorts of conditions. And we've worked really, really hard to make that happen. And that's what this piece of research really suggests, is that actually what we need to do is to start doing what we've done with those conditions over the last 12 years, replicate that for some of these, you know, less common conditions so that we do have the ability to have role models. We have the ability to have individuals who aren't famous, because we don't always need people to be famous, who are willing to kind of, you know, step up and talk without the fear that they're going to be treated negatively. And of course, until we've got a society where people feel confident that they're not going to be treated negatively, then we won't get case studies coming forward.
It feels like we're at that tension point that we've had with everything, with people coming out of being gay, with, you know, people who've drug addicts, that it's this stage when there's no one. It's of such, takes such bravery for people to step forward and really own their story. Yeah. Because when you don't have an empathetic society, the backlash for that can be extreme. And if you can't afford that backlash, like, you know, then who's going to take that step? So, you know, I'm just thinking, what are the other ways that we can do that without people having to put their kind of almost like their lives on the line to move us forward?
But it's really, really interesting, because whilst we say that, and I totally agree with you, we've got to make it safe for people to be able to speak up and speak out, and yet we've got a whole raft of people who have been willing to talk about the experiences that we've had with these less common conditions. And we've certainly been placing stories since we began on these conditions. It's not like we've just been ignoring it. But it's really interesting. So the take-up from the media is often less for, if you say, well, I want to place somebody who's going to talk about schizophrenia. And that is a reflection of the societal norm that says that that's a little bit out there, it's a little bit different. And some of that comes from our own experiences of, if we think about anxiety, for example, or depression, we've all had days where we felt a bit down. We've all had times where we've been anxious about stuff. Coming on here today is one of those for me. But we can identify then, if we then think about moving that into, well, if that was something that was like clinical depression or something that was really, really worrying me, I can make that leap and make that step. If I'm experiencing schizophrenia and I'm hearing voices, and those voices might be positive or they might be negative, that's quite a leap for people. So the whole point of this as a particular campaign in this week is to try to get people to understand the human nature of living with this as part of your human experience, and that then closes, what, in a technical term, closes that kind of social distance. So we don't think, the first thing that comes in our head isn't Maddox murderer. It's Billy, who was on, the Time to Change website, who talked about what it was like to live with the positives and the negatives, and how she coped with, just living with that as a condition, as part of her life. So if we can do that, that's really, really helpful. And then, of course, there's the other bits and pieces around education. So the work that we've been doing at Time to Change in schools is really, really important, because that helps us to make that kind of first kind of inroad. If we can get to people young, if we can start talking about this like it's everyday and ordinary, because we want people to understand that this, for lots of people, is their everyday and ordinary. It's not easy, but it is what they live with. If we can start to do that through education, that's brilliant. If we can go into workplaces, as we have done with depression and anxiety, and say, what are the reasonable adjustments that you're making in your workplace? What are your policies and procedures around people who might need to take some time off work with a mental health problem, regardless of what that condition is? Then that's how we start to kind of erode these misconceptions and these myths, and replace them with facts. And that's really, really key.
And if there's one thing that in particular employers could do to help people living with these conditions who are working for them, what would your suggestion be? How do you start that conversation in the workplace?
So again, online, loads of brilliant tips about starting conversations. So we've been working with employers really for the last 5 or 6 years. So they are able to sign up to what we call our Time to Change Pledge. And that's all about thinking about, how are you adopting your policies and procedures? How are you training your line managers? How are you making your workplace a mentally healthy place to be? How are you encouraging people to speak out? So we've had a lot of senior leaders who will speak out about their personal experience. That's one of the most powerful things. Because I think the fear often comes from saying, OK, I'm experiencing this, and what's the negative backlash going to be, as you mentioned? What's the negative backlash going to be for me? if a senior leader, if a chief executive within an organisation is willing to step up and talk about it, then everybody else in that organisation goes, well, one, this is the kind of place I want to work, and two, if I talk about it, I know from the top that it's going to get taken seriously, and that I'm not necessarily going to be in a place where there's going to be negative repercussions because I've spoken out. Mm. So it's all about that kind of reasonable adjustments, the ability for people to be able to talk about it, to be able to say, this is what my experience is, and by the way, this is what helps if I'm experiencing a mental health problem. Here are all the things that will be supportive and helpful for me. And these are the kinds of things that might trigger. And this is what you need to look out for. And this is how I would prefer to be treated within the workplace if that were to happen.
Jo, thank you so much for joining us. Jo Loughran there, Director of Time to Change, talking about how we can start to bring some of those less common, but just as important mental health issues into our daily lives and really talk about them in the same way that we now talk about things like depression and anxiety.
You've been listening to Badass Women's Hour. If you like the show, then help more people find us. You can tag us or talk to us on social media using @BadassWomen'sHour, or you can be really lovely and leave us a review and a rating. 5 stars, please. It helps boost us up the podcast rankings and allows other people to find us. We'll be back next week with more badass guests and in-depth chat.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.